Hello and welcome to All Africa's Focus on Peace Building in Africa, Silence the Guns. I'm Juanita Williams and today we speak about the role of young people in peace building, made all the more critical because of the continent's so-called youth bulge, which means that now more than half of Africa's population is under the age of 25, and by 2050, that population will reach over 830 million. At the World Innovation Summit for Education, aka WISE Summit, held in December 2021, one of the highlights was a session on peacebuilding as a way to explore the role young people play and how it affects education. Lakshita Saji Prelis, Director of Search for Common Ground and co-chair of the Global Coalition on Youth Peace and Security, moderated that discussion. First introducing Irene Griesel, who co-authored the collaborative 5-year strategy for the high-level global conference on youth-inclusive peace processes in Doha, Qatar in January 2022.
So I want to just highlight and emphasize some of the background to this output ahead of the Doha conference, which Saji has presented, noting that this strategic roadmap that I'll get into really focuses on a more specific component within the youth peace and security agenda, and complements the YPS guidelines that Selena will come in a moment, through focusing on the more specific area of peace and mediation processes. And I wanna recognize the 3 UN Security Council resolutions on youth peace and security, which call for the establishment of integrated mechanisms for meaningful participation of youth in peace processes, calling for inclusive representation of youth in the prevention and resolution of conflict, including when negotiating and implementing peace agreements, and recognizing that the participation of young people in peace processes can significantly contribute to the maintenance and promotion of international peace and security. And this framework roadmap that I'll get into really builds on the first global policy paper, which was launched 2 years ago in Helsinki, that really documented where and how young people shape peace processes and peace agreements, and why youth-inclusive peace processes are fundamental not only to the prevention of violence, but particularly to sustaining peace. So delving into that, and some of these points have already been raised, why do we talk about youth and peace processes? Why does it matter? We know that young people are often the largest demographic in countries with ongoing peace processes, and indeed, as Saji shared, the largest in the world today. For example, 72% of South Sudan's population is under the age of 30 years old. 67% of Afghanistan's population is under the age of 25 years old. And while over 1,000 peace agreements have been signed in the last 20 years, which is often the heart of peacemaking in a society that is undergoing conflict, there has been very limited attention and investment in the role and impact that young people have on peace processes. Young people also play an inherent role in the prevention of violence and sustaining peace. As documented in the We Are Here reports, young people demonstrate constructive and alternative channels to conflict resolution, often considered informal, but really fundamental in shaping the ground for sustaining peace and these formal processes. Young people often have long-term mindsets on peace. They focused on just issues that underpin healthy, peaceful, and equitable societies. Yet we find that they're seldom engaged as key strategic partners in building peace and co-leading conflict resolution. So really recognizing that there is both a political then and a demographic imperative to ensuring that peace processes are shaped by and supportive of young people's participation. This agenda, this strategy also recognizes that there is a rapidly changing conflict landscape. Violent conflicts are increasingly fragmented, protracted, and transnational. There's a rising prevalence and misuse of digital technologies. There's an escalating climate crisis and a global health pandemic. Traditional approaches are no longer as effective as previously. And so there's an urgent need to shift to a whole of society inclusive and long-term approach to conflict resolution and sustaining peace. And so coming then into what is this strategy? What is this roadmap that Saji has opened the floor for? So this is really a strategic action plan and builds on the title, We Are in This Together, to realizing more youth-inclusive peace processes. I want to emphasize that this has been a year-long, inclusive, transparent, and participatory process that has engaged almost 100 experts from across regional, international, and national organizations and contexts to really shape and take this strategy forward. Taking everything that's just been shared, the guiding vision is quite simple, that peace processes are supportive and shaped by young people's participation, ultimately realizing more inclusive and peaceful societies. The strategy has four key aims or objectives to lead us towards this vision. And that is that by 2026, we have established and strengthened political and institutional commitments to implement full and effective, meaningful participation of young people in peace processes, developing youth-sensitive and gender-responsive capacity-strengthening resources and knowledge tools to support youth engagement in peace processes, developing really a collaborative effort, a community of practice and partnerships to take this strategy forward, to implement, monitor, and collaborate. And finally, mobilizing sustainable resources and financing to realize the strategy's vision. The target really is the wide spectrum of actors, governments, mediation support units, civil society, international and regional organizations that are engaged in peace processes. And the aim is really to move from policy and norms to practice, from the why to the how of youth-inclusive peace processes. And that's to reflect the lived reality of young women and men in conflict and affected settings, really generating this holistic, long-term, intergenerational strategy that will create this environment for more youth-inclusive peace processes. Moving into briefly some of the substance of the strategy, it is founded and shaped by four key pillars or interconnected streams. And this is around institutionalization and policy, which is the systematic mainstreaming of youth-inclusive policies and practices within organizations and institutions. Capacity strengthening, which is about shaping and strengthening the attitudes, skills, and knowledge for more youth-inclusive practices, not only of young people, as is often assumed, but also institutional leadership, politicians, policymakers, civil servants, and civil society. Knowledge solutions is around building an evidence base. When we know more, we can do better. So this is around documenting the impact and best practice on how to include young people and how peace processes can be shaped by young people's participation. And finally, the strategy builds on the principle and the spirit of the Youth Peace and Security Agenda, which is founded on collaboration and partnerships for collective impact, really recognizing that our collective efforts together generate a stronger and a more sustainable impact than working in silo or segregated efforts. And this is the backbone through which we really want to take the strategy forward. There's a number of cross-cutting issues that underpin how to implement this strategy that really seek to do no harm in young people's participation and ensure that this is a meaningful strategy. And I can go into these perhaps in the question and answer, but this is around firstly, recognizing that security and protection of young people is fundamental in supporting their participation. Secondly, that recognizing young people are diverse, and so young people need to be considered from their different lived realities and experiences in conflict. Third, a strategy is only effective if it is funded with adequate resources to implement the actions. Fourth, communication. That's around harnessing the power of communication and shaping a new set of societal norms and the institutional acceptance of young people as necessary agents in the prevention of violence, in political decision-making, and in building foundations for peaceful societies. And finally, recognizing the potential of technology to both disrupt and facilitate peace processes. This is around harnessing innovation and digital technology in the design and implementation of more youth-inclusive processes. So just a few then closing considerations before we open the floor. The first is that we need to have a holistic shift in how we perceive and engage with young people. We must move beyond seeing youth as beneficiaries of peace processes, but as necessary partners and co-leaders essential in the prevention of violence and reconstruction of just and inclusive societies. This must be taken forward together and working together with young people. There must be buy-in from youth, and to ensure there is buy-in from young people, governments, international, regional, and national institutions responsible for peace efforts really need to reaffirm their relationship with young women and men as part of weaving a new social contract. And finally, and this has been raised before, there needs to be resources and serious commitment to this agenda. This includes mainstreaming of youth inclusive and gender responsive practices, but also investing sufficient resources to ensure that peace processes respond to the realities, challenges, and needs of young people of all genders within conflict societies, ultimately bringing us forward towards our common guiding vision of more peaceful, representative, and inclusive societies. I pause there and I thank you all. I open the floor for some questions and reflections.
Thank you, thank Irina. You. I hope you can hear the enthusiasm of the audience who is applauding to you, and I'm also hoping the online audience who is joining us also is applauding to you, because it's a very thorough presentation that you gave about a sneak peek. When I said a sneak peek, it was a really detailed, powerful presentation about what's going to be launched next month here in Doha, Qatar. So I'm going to open up for a few minutes to see if anyone from the audience has questions. There are mics on both sides. If you want to raise your hand, someone will come to you and you can ask questions. This is a conversation. This is not a one-way presentation. This is a conversation. So there are two questions. I'll come first there and then come here second. So Irina, you can hear us, right?
Hi, Irina. Thank you so much for all that you're doing. I was listening to you, and you were talking about the no harm policy. I love everything that's going on, but as a teacher, there is a part of me that youth have been beneficiaries because we're afraid. We want to protect them. And so if you could just elaborate more about the no harm policy and how we can have youth as equal partners without exposing them to unnecessary harm, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for the question. It's an important question. I'll come here. Leonardo has a question, and then we'll give a chance to Irina to respond.
Yes, thank you so much, Irina, for your question. My question is how to ensure the commitment of institutions and different governments to implement this agenda. We have been going with this for 5 years, 6 years already. Today's the anniversary. But when we see the progress on the ground and how meaningful is the participation of young people, that's the missing piece. That's something that's still lacking. So how can we push forward governments to really take this as a deep commitment that they have?
Wow, two important questions. I'm going to ask Irina to see if you can answer it, but also if Selena can also come in, because you're developing another guidance that the audience will hear from, who can also chime into this. So start with Irina.
Thank you so much for those questions. Those are really excellent points that you've raised. On the point of do no harm, this is really fundamental. We find that young people are already active and mobilizing and across different spaces. And I think it's the realization that we need to take that more seriously. It's not that young people are on the streets or seeking for participation or mobilizing different initiatives because they feel like it, but because it really has such essential contributions and it's a necessary component to an inclusive and a peaceful society. And so in the do no harm component, unfortunately, we find that young people in their striving for participation in different arenas, there are repercussions that they face, serious risks to their lives. And the various UN Security Council resolutions are calling for greater investment in protection of young people. So I see it as two ways. One, it's realizing that young people need to be taken seriously as partners, as co-leaders. And secondly, that in young people's participation, in creating spaces and opening these spaces, we cannot allow risks and repercussions in those spaces. We need to make sure that there are safe spaces in the negotiation room, as well as on the streets and civic spaces. So I hope that answers a little bit your question. And I think it's something that we need to continue to work on throughout this agenda. And ensuring these commitments, and thank you for raising that, Leonardo, that's critical. And that's what we're looking to do. And that's part of this event and also in the lead up to Doha, recognizing that, of course, change takes time, but also noting that there are small incremental steps we can take to not only commit, but then implement those commitments. And that's what the strategy seeks to do. We have, you know, next 5 years that we're looking to take steps towards more youth-inclusive peace processes, and the commitment of governments, of different institutions is fundamental in that, because partnerships and ensuring we do that together, it won't go far if we're not partnering. So I think it's, again, taking this seriously, making sure the commitments are serious and the investments, and taking those steps from the commitment to the implementation. That's a necessary step that needs to be taken moving forward. Thank you.
That was Irene Griesel, researcher, consultant, and trainer on youth peace and security, who co-wrote the 5-year roadmap after engaging with governments, mediators, young people, the European Union, African Union, and the United Nations. More than 50 countries are committed to joining the Youth Peace Processes Conference online, with foreign ministers, prime ministers, and presidents being present. The WISE Summit's peacebuilding session continued with Cameroonian peacebuilder Jone Shaden Epier, who is a project manager for Local Youth Corner Cameroon, a youth-led peacebuilding organization with over 20 years of experience. She also ensures gender mainstreaming at the organization and serves as the national program manager for the Commonwealth Youth Peace Ambassadors.
You've been at the forefront of taking these global policies, continental frameworks, and saying, what does this mean to us in Cameroon? And how us as young women and men lead a process and bring the government on board? Share with us what lessons you have learned and how you are leading this process in the country, Sharon. You do some amazing work with young people affected by terrorist activities also. So share with us what you're doing and what you're learning from it.
Well, thank you very much, first of all, for the opportunity to be here. I think that this is one of the reasons why young people want to be heard, because they want platforms like this where they can be able to express themselves and show what they have. So thank you, EAA and the WISE Foundation, for this opportunity. And before I get to the lessons learned, I'm going to talk about the reason why we even decided to engage in the localization of the YPS in Cameroon. Cameroon young people have been very much involved in peace building processes, in preventing and countering violent extremism, and even in transforming conflict and transforming violent extremism and de-radicalization processes. We as young people, we as youth actors, we involve ourselves in prisons, for instance, where we support violent actors or people who have been engaged in radicalization, in transforming them by vocational training activities within those prisons, where they can be able to learn that there are alternatives to violent extremism. We also do community dialogues, improbable dialogues, and so many other things which are related to building peace and countering violent extremism. But we realize that there are so many young people who are actually involved in these processes. We have a young person in the northwest region of Cameroon where there's conflict in the far north doing the same thing. But because we are kind of disunited, because we have so many great ideas, we have the energy, and the energy is not canalized into something big that we can actually be able to, you know, put ourselves together to be heard, it's always difficult for us to actually respond and have like the impact that we really want to see. So we decided to engage ourselves with the African Union, UNFPA, and other international organizations to localize the African Union Continental Framework on Youth, Peace, and Security, and to ensure that the voices of young people, irrespective of where they are in different communities from across the 10 regions of our country, are actually heard, and to ensure that their opinions and what they want to see within the National Action Plan is taken into consideration. So in October, we organized the first ever national symposium on localizing the African Union Continental Framework on Youth, Peace and Security, where we mobilized over 100 young people from the 10 regions, and particularly young people from the far north region, which is affected by the Boko Haram crisis, and those in the northwest, southwest affected by the Ambazonia crisis, if I would call it like that. And here, this was a platform where the different young people that were engaged expressed themselves. They spoke about the importance of us young people collaborating and working together to ensure that government takes seriously what we want to see within the National Action Plan. And some of the lessons that we learned, that we developed into some sort of roadmap towards which we will be able to implement the or develop the National Action Plan to inform over the next 5 years for Cameroon, was that we need to be able to build capacity, just as Dr. Roos was talking about, ensuring that young people have the necessary skills to be able to take action. Because it's one thing to have the energy, it's another thing to know how to effectively organize mediation processes, to be able to organize, to be able to monitor and even evaluate your actions at community levels. So that was one of the main things that the young people said they really wanted: capacity. And also at the level of seeing how we can be able to mobilize resources. With so many, let me just say that there are more than 500 civil society organizations in Cameroon. And among these 500, young people are very much active in it. And majority of them are very small, and having access to resources usually makes it challenging because you're too small, they cannot trust you with those kind of huge funds. So we realize that coming together through this National Action Plan will permit us to be able to work, develop concrete programs that can actually be sponsored by these organizations or by these stakeholders. We also realize the importance of engaging in stakeholders mapping, because in Cameroon, for instance, we have a lot of international organizations. We have a lot of government actors who are working with young people, who are supporting young people. But unfortunately, access is still difficult. For you, I remember when we were having a program that we were doing, we had to go to local administrations about 5 different times soliciting just for access, just to present the activity to them. So you can imagine, if it is that difficult at the local level, what more at the national level and even at the international level, where you hardly see those big guys. So realize that engaging in a stakeholders mapping and seeing those actors who can be able to facilitate, and even advocating that there are focal points for the Youth, Peace and Security agenda within those institutions that have been identified, to actually facilitate access for young people. And I mean, we realized a lot of different things that young people are interested in. And we also realized within this roadmap the necessity of having a monitoring framework for young people, a youth-led monitoring framework, which would also involve evidence-based research that actually informs what we want to do. So in the scope of everything that we discussed throughout this symposium, we have started working towards actually developing our National Action Plan. And in the next 2-3 months, we are going to be doing a national consultation, which is youth-led also. So the 100 young people that were identified are also going to restitute these same conferences or these workshops at local levels. And it's not just going to be young people alone, because in as much as we would recognize that young people make up 60% of the country's population, for instance, the remaining 40% is equally important, because they make the decisions, they have, you know, the governance and everything. So we ensure that these restitutions include traditional authorities, religious authorities. It includes IDPs because they too have something to say, and they're also affected by the conflict. It includes women because women are also among the most affected people, you know, during such conflicts. And also even includes children because children also have a role to play. And why not the military? Why not the police forces, because they are also at the forefront of security. So during these restitutions, we are going to do these consultations and find out what are the key things that we can be able to include within the National Action Plan. And also, these restitutions will enable us to be able to know that we have different conflict dynamics in Cameroon. The conflict in the Northwest Southwest region has a different dynamic. The one in the far north region has a total different dynamic. So we cannot say that we are just going to maybe do a national symposium and then impose it in the Northwest, impose it in the far north, impose it. We need to be able to actually take into consideration those different dynamics and then bring them all together to be able to develop something that reflects the diversity of young people and at the same time ensures that we are responding to these issues with one voice. So after the development of the National Action Plan, we don't want to end there. We don't want to say, okay, fine, we have this paper because it's going to be a paper. But after this, what are we going to do? How do we ensure that what is written down within this action plan is actually implemented? So we are going to ensure that we have, as I said before, a monitoring framework, a youth-led monitoring framework, a reporting mechanism that we can be able to show that, okay, those young people who have the opportunity to meet those big guys can actually talk for us, can be able to advocate for us, and can be able to report even to the lowest group of young people who are acting, and they can actually justify the actions that are being done. And even at the level of the government, ensure that the state has focal points where we can be able to reach out to them and work with them, which are targeting principally the Youth Peace and Security Agenda. I strongly believe that without us having these mechanisms that ensure that we can be able to stay accountable, it will be very difficult for us to actually achieve a sustainable action plan and also be able to see how far we have come, because when we develop the action plan 5 years down the line, we should be able to sit down and assess ourselves and say, okay, fine, this is what we achieved, these are the objectives we met, and this is what has to be done in the next other 5 years. So that's where we are for us. Thank you.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow. Way to commit. Way to commit. Thank you so much, Sharon, for your leadership and in this global agenda and how you're really taking ownership and making it yours. This is so critical. So thank you.
After listening to APA's contribution at the summit, it was clear that she had more to share. So I asked her a few questions about her work, noting, of course, the ongoing Anglophone conflict in the northwest and southwest of Cameroon.
Well, my role entails developing projects, writing, developing concept notes and project proposals that are in line with community conflict prevention, conflict resolution, conflict transformation. I also engage in implementation, such as, from developing activity work plans, logical frameworks, and other planning tools, and then implementation on the ground. We go to the field where we engage with the community, we have organized the activities and then do evaluation at the end of every project, ensure that there is constant monitoring and follow up throughout the project. So those are some of the things that I do as project lead from within my organization. Well, I work principally with Local Youth Corner, but we co-collaborate with other organizations, other civil society organizations in Cameroon, especially those that are working on peace building in the northwest southwest region of the country, as well as in the far north region. And when we have activities, when we have programs, we engage with them, we collaborate, and then implement at local levels, even at national levels. And we also work with other international organizations, specifically within projects or within programs.
And so you say that you work in the southwest of Cameroon, and I think probably a lot of people want to know what's happening there right now and what kind of work, what kind of work you've actually done in the southwest of Cameroon where the Anglophone crisis is happening. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Basically, since 2016, the crisis in the northwest, southwest region began, and you know, we've had a lot of clashes specifically between government and what I would call the secessionists. And these crises have, I always like to talk about the consequences because a lot of people focus on, a lot of people are trying to find like the answers. And while you're trying to find the answers to the reasons why these things are happening, people are dying every day, whereas you can actually be able to focus on the consequences and see how to be able to respond to these consequences. So, I mean, what has been happening in the region has caused a lot of loss of lives, a lot of internal displacement, a lot of people, especially children, young people and women have been affected. And, you know, the crisis only keeps getting worse. Attacks on schools, attacks on places that would rather not be be affected are actually being affected. So our organization, Local Youth Corner, since we began working there, we've been working specifically around engaging community dialogues, particularly improbable dialogues, where we have young people, we have bike riders, we have security actors, we have religious leaders, traditional authorities coming together to discuss and see how we can be able to get to common grounds to actually respond to the issues on the ground. We also have community mediation. We trained young people on community youth-led mediation approaches. And these young people within their communities act as mediators. They act as people, as liaisons to respond to those little crises that happen within the community that could spark into worse situations within the regions. And aside from the peace-building aspect, we also do a lot of humanitarian work there where we support children who have dropped out of school because of the crisis with recreation. So within our office in the region, we have some sort of recreational center with a library for children where they come and we teach them on how to engage in dialogues at an early age, the importance, the values of peace building, as well as help them with, you know, reading lessons and other things in order to ensure that they reserve that in despite the crisis and despite the conflict, they can actually reserve that education in them and not face the consequences after probably the crisis is ended, when we don't even know when it's going to end. So those are some of the activities that we do within the region. We also have some sort of social activities that promote social cohesion at community level, such as sporting activities for peace. And this is mostly around other regions that, I mean, those who have been displaced from the northwest, southwest are usually displaced and they end up in the littoral region. So there in the littoral, we have sporting activities which are we were preparing between host communities and IDPs, because one of the issues that we have noticed is that there's a lot of existing clashes between IDPs and host communities due to already limited resources, available resources, hate speech within those regions, and so on. So these little activities that promote knowing one another, promote collaboration, actually help, you know, as approaches of building peace, because it might be a bit difficult to bring them together to, you know, dialogue, have community dialogues, but, you know, sports is something that people connect with easily, and also even art, you know. So those are some of the things that we do as young peace builders. And just to note that our organization is mostly youth-led. Everyone there is between the age of 15 and 35. So by the time you get to the age 35, you're no longer eligible to work there. So everyone actually, and another thing is that everyone there is from, you know, a conflict-affected community. So they understand the dynamics, they have been there. And so we do most of our work with so much passion and commitment. So that's basically what we are doing within the Northwest and Southwest. And in as much as we also look at the consequences and try to respond to the effects, we also try to look at some of the causes of these crises. And that is why we engage in community dialogues, so that we can be able to understand the different sides and, you know, try to find common ground to actually be able to respond to these issues. Yes.
So the people that are involved in the Anglophone crisis and have in Anglophone conflict, why do you think it's been going on for so long? Because the work that you are doing obviously has helped the peace building progress. But what is holding it back?
Well, just to say that, I mean, there are so many reasons why conflicts, not only in the Northwest, Southwest, I mean, around the world, actually protract. You have warlords, you have people who benefit from the economy of conflict. That's a fact, and that's something that is existence everywhere around the world. We also have, I mean, misunderstandings. You can have a community dialogue, for instance, among with a group of people, and not all of them agree to, you know, those kind of things. So, I mean, there are so many dynamics, there are so many different reasons that actually prevent. And one of the things is that I always like to say is that you're going to the community to build peace, to you know, preach peace and all of that. It's not to solve the problem in one day, because the problem didn't start in one day. It's actually a process. And that is why we encourage many more young people to actually engage, because the more we engage ourselves, the more we take action, it's a process that would even become better. 5 years down the line, 2 years down the line, we can be able to see the outcome of our efforts, of our peace building efforts. And there is no direct why. I mean, if I tell you that I'm going to give you a response to why the conflict it continues, I would probably be taking one person's side or try to formulate something just to please you. But I would say that, you know, even as much as the conflict is protracted, we are still doing our best, and we're still working very hard to ensure that those pieces of peace that we are building actually yield something in the long term, because so that's basically it.
And you say that, so previously you mentioned that you use sport and art quite a bit in your peace building. What do those activities look like, and what kind of fruit have they borne for your organization?
Okay, so for the littoral region, we are starting this particular activity in January, but we have done this in the far north region, where we mobilized community, security, I mean, military, police, and justice sector actors to play together. And what we do is that the approach we use is that this community, this police, these security actors are put on the same team, so they get to play together. And while playing together, they get to know each other better. They get to collaborate, because you have to work together to be able to maybe score a goal. And when they score a goal, you see them hugging each other, something that would not happen, you know, in the norm. A police officer would probably in our context would not go and hug a young person just like that. But you know, when they are playing in this kind of informal context, they get to know each other better. And from there, it's easier to actually engage them in these community peace building processes and see how they actually work together. Another thing is that we realize that engaging in such activities, when we include also young women, it actually shows the role that young women can play. It shows that young women can also take part in sports activities. They can also engage in social cohesion activities. In the Far North region, for instance, where we worked in Mora, our sports tournament had both men and women. We had the female handball team, the male handball team. And for the first time after this sports tournament, another sports tournament came in, which initially never included women, started including women within those sporting activities. And you realize that, I mean, those little actions or those little activities of social cohesion actually yield fruit. There are also some young people who stated that they had never thought that they would actually play on the same team with a military personnel, because they know that military is military, and you see that they can actually connect. And when you connect with one another, it makes it easier for you to respond to the conflict, because you know that this conflict affects both the young people, the older people, and everyone within the community. So those are some of the things that these social cohesion activities actually help. We also have film production, community film screening and film production, where we develop a film within the community to reflect social cohesion and the role of different actors in peace building. And when these films are screened, the community is able to see how what role each of them can be able to play within the context of peace and security in their communities. So those are some of the things that sports and other artistic activities actually do when it comes to peace. So it's not just about organizing a sports tournament, but it's also about the approaches that we use, ensuring that both of them are engaged, you know, in are able to collaborate within these sporting activities, ensuring that they are able to relay information that project peace, that project working together for a common good, and project collaboration at the end of the day. Yeah.
Abby, you spoke about the importance of getting the young women involved and getting youth involved. Now, those are two separate questions, but can I ask you, what is the importance of having young people involved specifically? Why is that such a major hurdle for peace building to cross? And why is it important for more young women and more young people to be involved in peace building?
I mean, young people are the crossroad of conflicts everywhere in the world, especially in Cameroon. I'll take the context of Cameroon. Majority of those who are fighting or who are in crisis or in conflict are young people. Majority of those who are even responding to these issues are young people. I don't know, at the WISE conference we had during my presentation, I stated that we have over 300 organizations, and in these organizations we have so many young people who are actually actively participating. So we realize that since young people are the crossroad of these conflicts, it is very important to actually engage them to take action and to actually build peace, because they are at the end of the day, they are the ones who are most affected. And we also have that the fact that young people are over 60% of the population or the country's population or even the population of Africa. You see, this demographic majority makes it important that we actually pull them towards peace building. And, you know, providing them alternatives such as engaging them in peace building processes means that we are actually reducing their rate of engaging in conflict or in violent extremism. So those are some of the reasons for young people. Now, for young women, it is very important for them to be engaged, because I believe that personally, for instance, as a young woman, women have more tolerance compared to men, and building on such tolerance actually makes it possible for them to actually mobilize community to take action in peace and security actions. And at the same time, we have young women who are also among the most affected. When it comes to conflict, when you talk about gender-based violence in conflict context, young women are the most affected. When it comes to domestic violence, young women are the most affected. So it is very important that young women also take action. And also when it comes to de-radicalization processes, in the far north, for instance, majority of those who dropped their guns and all of that got the information about DDR centers from their wives, from their girlfriends, or from a female partner. So you realize that it's very important to actually engage these young women within peace-building processes.
Earlier you were speaking about the process of peace-building and the fact that people think that you go in and then there's going to be peace. So what is the process of peace building? And I know that it's quite a long process, can be quite involved, but if you could just take us through an example of what the peace building process is.
So as I was saying, building peace is not like a humanitarian work where you just check the boxes, we gave this number of things and all of that. It involves mediation, it involves dialogue, it involves bringing people together over and over, people who, you know, in normal circumstances would not sit to talk about an issue. It involves getting common grounds or engaging people to find common grounds, actually respond to the problems that they have. So at my level, as a peace builder, you're like a facilitator. You're not like the solution finder. You're the one who facilitates the process of finding solutions to the problems that two people, or to the disagreement that two people or more groups are facing with one another. And this could be done through, as I said initially, dialogues, engaging them, mobilizing them, or bringing them together to take part in dialogues, in conversations, which could be formal and informal conversations, you know, bringing them to, as a mediator, you mediate these kind of conversations with them. Those are the processes of peace building. And then we also have the aspect of transforming conflict or transforming violent extremism, where you talk about using more more relatable initiatives or more relatable actions, such as maybe we can talk about skills building, providing alternatives to those who are actually pushing forward the conflict or the violence within the communities. For instance, within our initiatives, we have this Creative Skills for Peace, which is like a vocational training opportunity for young people who have had history of violent extremism and have been in prisons, where we provide them with vocational skills in such as transforming tires to shoes, tailoring, hairdressing, and so on and so forth. And through these activities, they are able to see that they don't necessarily need to be violent. They don't necessarily need to go towards conflict in order to make a living out of life, but they can actually be more useful citizens within their communities. So those are some of the approaches that we can be able to use when it comes to, you know, peace building, conflict transformation.
So earlier you were speaking about education and what effect it has on young people when they are still at school, whether they're at school or university. And recently you attended the Y Summit in Doha. And so I want to know about that experience and what that's like. Just meeting with all those education and some peace building experts as well. What was that like to attend that and to be on one of the panels?
Yes. So, I mean, the WISE conference was a great opportunity to actually present the work that young people are doing and give an opportunity for young people to be heard and for young people to actually show that they are taking action wherever they are coming from, and especially when it comes to education. And one of the things that I really particularly appreciated was the fact that within this education summit, there was a panel to discuss around peace building, because one of the main causes or one of the main reasons why so many children are out of school, especially in Cameroon, we have more than 300,000 children who have dropped out of school as a result of violent conflict. So you realize that there is like peace building or peace is very, very integral to peace, to education, or to access education for children around the world. So the WISE conference was really a great opportunity to demonstrate how this, the importance of education and the important role young people are actually playing within this, ensuring that there is sustainable education for children around the world, and especially for children in Cameroon. And for me particularly, it was a wonderful experience. After my presentation, a lot of young people came to me saying that they were very inspired and they were very happy to have, you know, taken part and heard what I had to say. So just the single fact that I was able to contribute in a little way to inspiring young people to also take action towards peace building and ensuring there's youth-led community engagement across, you know, in at the WISE and even out of the WISE conference was really elating for me. I was really, really happy that I had the opportunity to do that. And I believe that it doesn't end there. It doesn't just end at the level of making speeches in summits, but actually coming back home and taking action or continuing the work that, you know, we have been doing even before we had the opportunity to talk within those platforms. So that's exactly how I felt within that opportunity, or being given that opportunity. And as I said earlier, a lot of times we don't get the chance to actually talk about the work we do. And those are some of the reasons why young people feel discouraged and they don't feel pushed.
Thank you so much, Shannon, for making yourself available to speak about your experiences as a peace builder in Cameroon, as well as your presentation at the Y Summit in Doha. You were listening to All Africa's Silence the Guns podcast, focusing on peace building in Africa. All Africa is grateful to the Carnegie Corporation for supporting its reporting on peace building on the continent.